This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of March, and this week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced the immediate lifting of COVID-related capacity restrictions in the state. He also immediately lifted the state's mask mandate. Now, the third COVID wave has significantly abated since its peak earlier this winter, and the fraction of the population that's been vaccinated keeps rising at an improving clip. But we're still seeing about 2,000 deaths a day across the country, and there are some signs that the decline in case rates is stalling out. So this feels maybe a little bit early. And other states are making different choices than Texas. Mississippi went along with what they did, but Alabama extended its mask mandate for another month. West Virginia Governor Jim Justice is keeping restrictions in place for now, too. Those are both also Republican-led states. And in states led by Democrats, we are seeing moves to lift restrictions, but often in a more deliberate way. Connecticut, for example, which has been one of the most effective states getting vaccinations out, announced that restaurants, offices, houses of worship, gyms, and other public places will be free to operate with no capacity restrictions starting about 2 weeks from now, but the mask mandate will stay in place. There was good news from the federal government this week on the transition back to normal. There will be enough vaccine for every eligible American by the end of May. That's an acceleration of 2 months from the previous promise. To talk about where we are, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post on the right. Hello, Megan.
Hi.
And on the left, Christine Emba, also a columnist and editor at the Washington Post. Hello, Christine.
Hey, good to be back.
Good to have both of you back on the show. So, Megan, did Texas move too early here?
Look, I think for the southern states where cases have, in general, been getting more of a boost from the weather than we are up here in where I am in Massachusetts, where it is still a balmy 33 degrees, there's maybe an argument that as we're able to vaccinate the more vulnerable populations, which means that even if cases keep going, the deaths and the hospitalizations are likely, we hope, to keep falling. That maybe the cost of saving the few additional lives just isn't worth the incredible amount that we're paying by having everything be closed, the small businesses that can't hang on, and so forth. But then I think you have to look at the mask mandate. Why? This is the cheapest possible way to lower the cost of reopening businesses. And, you know, in some ways, it might actually make the anxious people more willing to go into your shopping mall, for example, if there's a mask mandate and they can be assured before they get there that everyone is going to be covered. So why lift it this early? And I think that goes to the fact that Republicans have just gotten way too invested in this symbolic politics of like, no. And I think it's actually, in many ways, just hampering the party from putting forward a more positive agenda that might appeal to voters in 2022 and in 2024, as well as, I think, being dubious policy. But I think it's not no longer about policy. It is about sending signals that, you know, you hate the libs more than anyone else in the party.
Yeah, Christine, as Megan alludes to there, obviously these restrictions are not all alike. My view is also that the mask mandate should sort of be the last thing that you lift because of its relatively low cost compared to forcing closures and reduction capacities in various kinds of public places. And I think we're seeing that in the public policy of a lot of blue states, like that Connecticut move, where they're going to keep the mask mandate while reopening at full capacity offices and gyms and that sort of thing. On the other hand, we've seen a lot of these jurisdictions in blue states as well as in red states where the reopening of restaurants has proceeded faster than the reopening of schools. And that strikes me as an incorrect order of operations, that if you're going to, you know, opening schools should have been a higher priority in terms of allowing congregated activities when conditions allow than opening certain businesses. But there's been so much of a focus on tax revenue and the things associated with those businesses. And that I think has driven a little bit of a misprioritization.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, first to take a step back, I think that the reopenings in Texas and Mississippi are crazy and a terrible idea. There's a running joke on social media that I agree with that apparently Governor Abbott, you know, planned and promised to kill all Texans, and the ones that he, you know, didn't manage to freeze to death by mismanaging the electrical system, he's going to get with coronavirus before his term is done. It is incomprehensible to me why he would choose to lift these mandates after there's probably already been a surge in COVID transmission from people sheltering with their families, with each other in, you know, in unregulated places due to the crisis that just ended a week and a half ago. But that said, it is interesting that there is so much more, I would say, interest given to or coverage given to restaurants reopening and businesses reopening instead of schools. But I also unfortunately think that this is part of a larger American problem, one might say, in that we tend to focus more on commerce and making sure that business is happening, as opposed to sometimes the, you know, quieter underlying things that would help families function better, that would help our real lives function better, that might actually serve human beings a little bit better. Things like daycare, schools opening, helping parents be able to take care of their children and manage their own lives. This is a misprioritization that, you know, has always been in place in this country, especially over the past, you know, 3 to 4 decades. But the coronavirus crisis has just made it more obvious that this is a mistake.
It seems to me there's been a lot of public discussion about the schools and a lot of news coverage focus on it. And I think that there's this overly simplistic narrative that says, like, teachers' unions want schools to be closed and therefore they're closed. There's a really sharp divide in public opinion among parents about whether schools should be operating in person or not that I think sort of mirrors the actually quite, you know, divided approach that we're seeing around the country in terms of hybrid models, in addition to some districts that have almost no person in-person instruction and others that are back to full in-person operation. But I mean, Christine, what do you see as missing there? I think people are talking about this. What's the step that would have to have been taken that hasn't been taken that would have gotten more of those schools open?
So I think one of the things that people are still confused about is transmission rates with children and what exactly schools need to function safely. Teachers unions seem to have, you know, one quite strong view on this, which is kind of, you know, the extremes that all teachers need to be vaccinated is what the teachers union in California is saying, for instance, or that schools need to be, you know, fully outfitted with, you know, new filtering HVAC systems, et cetera, et cetera. Things like that would be expensive and take time to put into place and haven't been done for many schools yet. So if you do believe that, then it is, you know, hard for schools to open. But I think that more time could be spent, you know, exploring other methods of school opening. In California, in the South, in warmer states, it is getting warmer. Could school be taking place outside? Would that be safer? How would that lower transmission rates? Would parents feel comfortable with something like that? Are there mixed or hybrid methods of schooling that are not just forcing five-year-olds to sit in front of a Zoom screen all day, but, you know, actually creating some interaction that could be not risk-free, but lower risk and possible to put into place? And what would those investments look like? If we say that it has to be all one thing, schools completely closed, or all the other things, schools totally open and everything back to normal, neither of those is likely, you know, very quickly at this moment. There should be more discussion of what we could do in between and what that might actually look like, and then also what the repercussions, if any, would be. There's still a lot of research missing, even though we have been doing this for a while now.
Megan, it seems to me that on both schools and on restaurants and a lot of other aspects of the restrictions, there's a certain degree of inertia and it pushes in different directions, which is to say that, you know, there's a lot of pressure to get restaurants open because of the jobs and the tax revenue. And on the flip side, in schools, there's a lot of inertia that keeps them closed because of the difficulty of meeting the tests that that Christine describes there being imposed in a lot of places and not for crazy reasons. And part of what I see as a difficulty here is a lot of people, when they see a policymaker or an advocate saying, you know, well, we can't do this yet because we're still not out of the woods on coronavirus. There's not enough of an understanding of when we're going to be out of the woods. And I think the federal government has really not led here in the way that they needed to. In a place like Texas, if you're trying to argue to people, now is not the time to lift the mask mandate, especially, and now is not the time to go back to, you know, full 100% service in restaurants, you should be able to say to people, you know, it's going to be a matter of weeks, not months, before we're in a position where we're going to be able to do that. But the Centers for Disease Control has been extremely reluctant to say anything about how you and how society can change when a large fraction of people are vaccinated. That guidance has been extremely cautious. And the result of that has been people don't have a sense that this is just going to go on for months and months and months more. And I think that encourages people to throw their hands up.
Yeah, I think you've got a real problem, which is that the discourse around vaccines, for example, where people are saying, well, after you get vaccinated, of course, you can't change anything, except I think the one thing that they've allowed is that if you have a known COVID exposure and you've been vaccinated, you don't need to quarantine if you're asymptomatic. It's like, ooh,
but
wow.
Only if you were vaccinated more than 14 and what? Less than 90 days ago, which is crazy. This 90-day, nobody thinks the vaccines only work for 90 days. It doesn't drive any other part of our public policy, and yet that's in the official guidance.
Yes, and so there's this insane reluctance to say, hey guys, I think Israel's doing the right thing, right? Hey guys, get vaccinated, and then you can go in the nightclub. Come, like, get a shot. They literally have a campaign at some nightclubs, get a shot, have a shot. I mean, it's like, you know, that's the right way to approach it, right? Is that you should be telling people, like, get a vaccine. It's awesome. You can hug your mom. You can have the kids over. Like, all of this stuff that people haven't been able to do. And instead, our public health community, and this has gone throughout the whole pandemic, is they don't want to say anything unless they're so 100% sure that they it can't possibly be wrong. So for example, with the transmission risk, if you're vaccinated, right? Look, I think that maybe it's possible that you can transmit a little bit if you've been vaccinated, but I also think it's pretty clear that it's going to cut your transmission risk at least somewhat. And they're not saying that. They're just saying we don't know. And yet, at the
increasingly,
same time,
it looks like it cuts it by a lot, not just by somewhat.
Exactly. But I'm being conservative. But I think there's clear evidence, right? Is that this is very likely to cut transmission risk substantially. And yet, at the same time, these are the same people who lied to us about needing masks, right? I mean, like the credibility here and the willingness to give people endpoints that they can reach. I think there's a real argument that all states should be saying, instead of reopening, should be saying to everyone, like, look, guys, we've got the vaccine. It's like 2 months. Just give us, like, give me another 2 months. We're going to get this thing licked and then it's done. You know, is that our hope and our expectation is that if we can do another 6 weeks, that we can and vaccinate people aggressively, that we can knock transmission so low that, like, functionally you just shouldn't have to worry about it this summer or onwards. And no one's saying that. And so, yeah, people throw up their hands. And I think that the messaging has been muddled the whole way along. Most countries do a better job at messaging this than we do. And partly that's because we're fragmented. But I think, you know, you also have this issue is that there are good things about America's decentralization, but the bad thing is, you know, and to go back to schools and restaurants, like the people who close and open restaurants aren't the same people who close and open the schools, especially on the West Coast where it's elected school boards in elections that are completely dominated by the teachers' unions. And so, you know, saying, yes, this is sort of crazy, but it's also that decision isn't, it's not like there's someone making a direct trade-off there. And, you know, also, frankly, if schools staying closed meant that they were likely to go bankrupt and shutter and the teachers in them losing their jobs, the schools would be open. Private schools are open. And there's a reason for that. And the teachers' unions at the end of the day, yes, there's parent reluctance too, but, you know, they're not creating options for reluctant parents. They're just keeping all the schools closed. And the reason that that is happening is that the teachers' unions don't want to go back and they're dragging their feet. And in places where it's politically possible for that to succeed, they are succeeding. And it's not because it makes more sense to have restaurants open. It's because the teachers, at the end of the day, their expectation is the tax base is going to be there and it's going to keep paying me. So there's no reason for me to go back unless I am actually forced to.
I totally agree on the messaging problem. I mean, we also, a horrible, sad anniversary. Next week, I think, will be kind of the anniversary of everyone's sort of first week of COVID realization last year. And we can remember that messaging folly, which was 2 weeks to bend the curve. Like, it'll just be 2 weeks and then we'll all be back at work. And that clearly didn't happen since we are recording from home here a year later. It's kind of been, honestly, it's been a farce from the start. Our messaging has been fragmented, has sometimes been false. And early on in the pandemic, yes, that was perhaps because we just didn't have all the information. It was a new thing. We were still learning about this disease. And it does feel like in the, I want to say, back half of the pandemic, or can I even say that? Like, what is time now anyways? But we've overcorrected into, you know, oh, we don't want to make that mistake again. We don't want to say people need, you know, not to wear masks. We don't want to repeat this. So we're being extremely, extremely, extremely overcautious in what we say. And yes, as Megan was saying, not giving people any hope.
I think we're about to have a new messaging challenge, though, which is that sooner than people expect, we're going to shift from there being more vaccine demand than supply to there being completely sufficient vaccine supply. And we need to go out and convince the people who haven't gotten vaccinated to do so. And I'm a little bit worried about how that messaging is going to work. Megan, one thing we're seeing in the polling is that vaccine hesitancy is especially high among white Republicans. And now I would caution about this. The data scientist David Shore raised a key caveat, which is that if you ask people whether they've actually been vaccinated, there's a much smaller partisan gap than when you ask people about whether they intend to get vaccinated. So maybe this isn't as big a problem as it looks like it is in the polls, that, you know, people don't always accurately report what they are intending to do in the future. But it's still, there's still some gap, even in the actual vaccination. And it looks like there might be a lot of Republicans out there who have been, you know, a little bit skeptical of the government's actions on COVID all the way through, who are hesitant to get this vaccine. What do we do to get them to get vaccinated?
I think there's two possibilities. And I think looking at Israel is an interesting case because Israel had this, right? They went from everyone getting lauded because they were just vaccinating around the clock to now they're like basically begging people to get vaccinated. Because as you know, the people who are getting vaccinated right now are the people who have been at home for a year, right? Who want to get back out, who are desperate to get back out. They are old people. They are people with high risk conditions and so forth. As we move into younger populations, we are going to hit hesitancy because why should they get a vaccine? They're not worried about dying anyway. And you're also going to hit those pockets of resistance. We have seen that people of color are more likely to express some hesitancy, though, again, we don't know if that means they won't get it. And so I think with communities that are hesitant, you need to target them. I think we should be targeting Republican politicians. You know, Mike Pence could be out there talking up the great Trump vaccine and how, you know, liberals have been really unfair about Trump's vaccine and how great they're underselling how great it is. And like, you know, and you could get politicians going out there, work with churches, work with community leaders. But that outreach is actually made harder by other stuff that is happening. And my biggest fear is that this gets identified as like a liberal vaccine. And when you jump on Texas and Mississippi and don't jump on Connecticut, which, you know, I love masks, but they're not so effective that if you really think that reopening is a problem, then you should be jumping on Connecticut because they're reopening too. If people who are in the more blue statey vaccine, pro-vaccine community turn this into a political issue and use it as a way to bash Republicans and make fun of Republicans for being dumb and not getting how great this vaccine is, they're not going to take the vaccine. So we should knock it off.
Christine, what do you make of what Megan described that we've seen in Washington, D.C. and in a lot of other large cities where the population that got vaccinated initially was very disproportionately white? There have been efforts to try to focus vaccination in African-American communities that I think have had mixed success. What have we learned?
We're not necessarily learning something new. This is something that became far more obvious to us at the very beginning of the pandemic. Some communities have more time and resources on their hands, better internet, more computer access, time to sit and stare at a website and game it at 9 a.m. on a Friday morning and Thursday morning when vaccine appointments opened up online in D.C. And often these are classes that are, you know, more educated and they get to be first in line. That that's sort of how it goes in the United States and in Washington, D.C. So full disclosure, I live in Washington, D.C. I live in a targeted zip code, and I am in one of the earlier tiers for vaccine appointments. Because I am able to sit on a computer and game the terrible website, I was able to get a vaccine appointment, and I was fascinated to see that even though I tried to sign in on, you know, one of the days that was reserved for these targeted zip codes, and it took many tries to, you know, get an appointment. It's not that this necessarily makes more appointments. The appointments are limited, and it doesn't actually make them necessarily that much more available. There is still a lot of competition. And when I did get to a vaccine site, I was surrounded by members of the professional class. But that said, in speaking to friends, family members, people in my neighborhood, there is a targeting problem for, you know, Black people in DC. You're right. For many, the question is a little bit of vaccine skepticism, but it's less, you know, don't get the vaccine, and more, maybe I should wait and see until, you know, a few more people have gotten it. Or even maybe I'm interested, but I just don't necessarily know that much about it. Or maybe it's, I could have been convinced to take it probably if it was easy to get. But if I'm a little bit skeptical and also very busy, I'm not going to waste my whole day trying to figure out this crazy thing that, you know, it's barely understandable. I think that, you know, this is a messaging problem. This is actually something where, alas, influencers, whether it's going to churches and asking them to help, whether it's, you know, getting on radio stations, the things that, you know, larger segments of the population, including the Black population, might listen to rather than press releases on the DC government website or tweeting about vaccine appointments, could actually be very useful. It would have to be hands-on work, and it would have to be more creative. And unfortunately, many cities are not resourced for that or have not turned their attention in that direction yet.
I, for one, am surprised to hear that there are people who do not spend all of their days reading press releases on the DC website. But if you say
it's shocking. It is shocking.
I will be back with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post to talk about COVID relief. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist and editor at The Washington Post. The COVID relief bill has passed the House of Representatives on a near party line vote and is, as we tape, being debated in the Senate. Senators are changing the package a little bit. Moderate Democratic senators got language that tightens the eligibility for relief checks among upper-middle-earning households. So if you're a single person making $90,000 a year, you won't be getting a partial relief check like you might have. But this change is pretty small in the scheme of things. It takes $12 billion out of a $1.9 trillion package. There also won't be funding for a subway into Silicon Valley in the Bay Area, but again, you know, that's kind of a drop in the bucket in the $1.9 trillion. We have a pretty good sense of how this package is going to be shaped when it becomes law. Christine, how important is this change to the relief checks? Because it's been the focus of so much of the coverage. And, you know, I understand, you know, that the thing that is the contentious point of debate in shaping the package, I understand why people focus on that. But I feel like it's been a little lost that, for example, the package raises the child tax credit to $3,000 from $2,000 and also makes it easier for people with low incomes to claim that credit. It feels like this check issue has gotten like so much of the fixation.
Right. Well, you know, people have been fixated on the relief checks from the beginning because, you know, getting a check for $2,000 or $1,400 or some amount of money in your mailbox is, exciting, fascinating, and worth arguing about. I think that if narrowing check eligibility helps get this bill through the Senate, fine. I also think that part of the reason why this narrowing is getting so much focus is that, you know, wealthier workers, which is not to say rich workers, but, you know, people who may be making $100,000 a year and thought they would get a check and now might not, tend to have more resources saved, tend to have, you know, more time on their hands, and also probably have time to complain and call their representatives and get mad about this shift. Whereas people who might be affected by other portions of the bill might not. And also, again, checks are easy to understand and talk about.
Megan?
I think the checks are dumb to start with. so I'm happy to that they're getting smaller, just because I think that this isn't what the, we don't need stimulus. Household finances have never been in better shape. You know, the people who are employed are still, they've been saving, their household balance sheets are radically improved. Low interest rates have allowed a lot of them, including, full disclosure, my household, to refinance into ridiculous mortgage rates where, you know, you're sort of pushing a zero real interest rate. No one needed a stimulus check. The people who needed checks.
Well, some people needed the stimulus check, right?
I mean, the people who need checks are the
average household balance sheet looks better, but a lot of people have been unemployed for a long time.
Right, and those are the people who will get checks.
But everyone's getting a check. What, the people who should have gotten checks are the people who are unemployed, the people who are losing small businesses, who, for whom $1,400 is not in any way going to cut it, right? We should have been, if, you know, we can argue about how much we should have spent on this totally, but the relief should have been way more targeted towards the people who are actually suffering from the pandemic. This is not a situation where we need to stimulate the economy. The reason that the areas of the economy that are depressed are depressed is because we want them to be, so that they won't transmit COVID. And the rest of the people are doing basically okay. So funnel the money more towards the people who need relief. Don't use this as a big grab bag of, you know, what was the minimum wage doing in there? And unfortunately, for political reasons, what we're getting is something that is, people like getting checks and they will feel good about Joe Biden because they got a check. But, you know, that's spending money that we don't have. We're borrowing it. And it's spending money that we could have better spent on people who are actually needy.
Yeah, Christine, there's been this back and forth about, should these bills be described as relief packages? Should they be described as stimulus packages? And obviously, there are elements of both there. But on Friday morning, we got a very good jobs report, several hundred thousand jobs created, significantly beating expectations. Now, we're going to need a big acceleration from that in order to get back to the pre-pandemic job situation. But I think it's likely that we are going to have that acceleration. The jobs report that we saw this week, that reflects the job situation as of February 12th. So we already have had a few weeks of pretty good return to normal that aren't reflected in that. And then you're going to see in lots of states, restaurants reopening, people resuming air travel, that's going to create new jobs. And so what do you make of this discussion about, you know, does the economy actually need stimulus policy in order to get back from where it is right now? Or is that just sort of going to happen as the pandemic wanes?
Yes, interesting question. So the jobs report is encouraging, but actually, as Joe Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, said, it's not enough. The jobs report did show some gains in, you know, leisure in these spaces that have been dampened by the pandemic and also by winter, frankly. It's great that some, you know, restaurants are opening up, et cetera, et cetera. But it also showed that, you know, continued job losses in state and local government are actually holding down overall gains in job growth and in economic growth. That isn't going to go away. Those cuts are not going to disappear overnight. State and local governments will continue to need support. And that is something, a major part of this relief bill. And it will be considered relief. And, you know, we aren't going to be fully open by March 14th, which is when unemployment benefits run out for, you know, millions of Americans around the country. That's next weekend. People will, you know, still unfortunately need benefits to take care of their families, to feed their kids, even if their jobs come back, even if they are rehired, we're seeing backloads of debt, whether it's, you know, unpaid rent, whether it's mortgage bills coming due. You know, not everybody was fortunate enough to be furloughed and, you know, sit on their job or be able to work from home. There is a large segment of the population that is struggling from the pandemic, was struggling before, and is now even in a worse place, even as our country hopefully continues to open up. And as we were talking about with vaccine hesitancy, with masking hesitancy, just because the pandemic is getting better doesn't mean that people are going to snap back to normal, start hiring, start spending in the same way that they would have, or, you know, what would be really helpful for the economy, frankly, double what they would have in the past. We have to get from today, you know, March, to basically August, September into next year to see a full recovery. And we will need support to do that. The stimulus will be important. Relief will be needed.
I think the unemployment enhancement part of the relief package is a point of consensus among the three of us. I mean, maybe not precisely in the details, but this package will extend those unemployment benefits and enhance the amount of them for several months in toward the end of the summer. But Megan, if this package is too big overall, if it's stimulating an economy more than is necessary, what's the risk there? If the economy overheats, and there's, you know, there's really intense competition to hire workers as all these restaurants reopen, doesn't that just put positive pressure on wages? The Federal Reserve doesn't seem alarmed by this and is saying that they're going to be patient as they watch. You know, there could be transient effects that look like upticks in inflation because the economy is going to go through a weird time reopening, but they're not freaked out about that. Why should we be freaked out about any of that?
Well, I'm not worried about monetary policy. I think banks are worried about monetary policy right now. And the bond market has been very interesting recently. But yeah, the Fed should be keep its foot, you know, don't get anywhere near the brake for a while. And I'm not arguing against, I think I said, I'm not arguing that we shouldn't be helping unemployed people. We should be helping unemployed people. I am in favor of enhanced unemployment benefits for unemployed people. I think it is ridiculous that it has taken this long to extend the bill. We told those people to stay home so that they wouldn't give people a disease, and we should make them whole from the damage that we've done from that. So I think all of those things are good. I think helping state and local governments, you know, put better HVAC in schools, that's totally fine. That said, actually most of the money on schools isn't even going to be spent by September. You know, I mean, it's very small, and then most of it ends up getting spent next year when we hope that this is going to be a much less pressing need. But we haven't targeted it adequately towards doing things like rushing to get the schools reopening. We haven't targeted it towards the people who are suffering. And I think the big risk is, like, look, I think that in an emergency, there is a good argument for borrowing money to spend on that crisis. I have consistently throughout this crisis, and in some ways have been advocating for spending more on things like trying to keep businesses running with their payrolls open, so that even if they can't actually serve customers, you know, especially the restaurants, the leisure, and so the hospitality, they can sort of keep that social capital, the institutional capital of having a team that works there and so forth, and helping subsidize those operations until we get back to normal, and keeping people in work and attached to work. And I think they want to be attached to their jobs. They're not happy that they're on unemployment. And we should have done more of that than we have. But at the end of the day, we're borrowing money that has to be paid back. Yes, interest rates right now are ridiculously low, but that's not like a law of nature. That is something that can change. And if markets get worried that we will not repay the debt, either by inflating its value away or by just defaulting on it, then it will change. And that tends to happen very unpredictably. And when it happens, it usually happens at the worst possible time. It usually happens when you're dealing with another crisis and you don't really have fiscal capacity to start paying down your debt. And all of a sudden, you have to do it fast. And I think that Democrats, the worry for me is that, look, Republicans have been far too blasé about that when they're spending the money on tax cuts. But Democrats now seem to be vying to outdo them by spending even more money on spending. And in some ways, tax cuts are a lot easier to reverse. You raise the rate and then the taxes go up. With spending programs, you end up with people who built their lives around depending on those spending programs. And so I think that I am deeply worried about the fiscal attitude that it just doesn't matter, that we're borrowing money to send $1,400 checks to most of the people in the country who don't need them.
I think this is also just kind of a second order question and an argument that we will have forever. What should you do in an emergency? Should you wait to make sure a bill is as tightly targeted and correctly targeted as possible so that, you know, we don't frighten the horses or increase national debt? Or should we recognize that it's an emergency, throw some money out there and hope it works and, you know, try and figure it out on the back end? In the spring, markets freaked out because there was a pandemic and they weren't sure what the government was going to do about it. That was scary. Having a, you know, kind of poorly targeted and weird omnibus stimulus helped stabilize things a lot. We will have to pay for it eventually. Should we not have done that? It's a strategy question. It's one that politicians will be talking about forever. But it seems pretty clear that giving people relief, even if it's not perfect, during an emergency is a good thing. At least that's my opinion.
Can we talk a little about the minimum wage? Megan mentioned, you know, why was a minimum wage increase part of this COVID relief package? It's a longstanding policy goal of Democrats. It doesn't have a particular nexus to COVID. In fact, when you have a labor market situation like this where unemployment is elevated, that's kind of an odd time to do a large minimum wage increase. But anyway, it's not going to be in this package, and it remains a longstanding Democratic priority. So, Christine, what is the path forward for a minimum wage increase? It's a popular idea. You're seeing Republicans, several of them in the Senate, flirting with the idea of being in favor of some sort of minimum wage increase. What's the path forward to get one enacted?
Yeah, this is interesting. This is also a strategy problem, I think. Why was the minimum wage included in this bill? Because we're seeing a huge amount of intransigence from Republicans and negative polarization. Joe Biden promised a minimum wage increase and thought that, you know, goodwill around a COVID stimulus was at least extant, and maybe if he just tried to throw the minimum wage in there, it might get passed without as much arguing as it would have at another time. It didn't work. He gave it a shot. That's fine. I think that there is bipartisan support for an increased minimum wage, at least among voters. Even if you look at how red states, Trump-voting states, voted in November, even if they didn't support Biden at all, many of them, like Florida, overwhelmingly supported minimum wage increases. It seems that the Republican political class is more against the minimum wage increase than their voters. I think we're just going to continue to see a lot more wrangling and dialogue on this question. I think, hopefully, some perhaps more populist, or maybe I would say faux populist, representatives on the Republican side, like Josh Hawley, who I have neither time nor respect for, are beginning to realize that this is a winning argument. I think it will change. It's just going to take longer than people hoped.
Megan, the last two times that the federal minimum wage was increased, there were laws passed in 1996 and 2007. Those were bipartisan compromises with overwhelming votes in favor of them. And there were small business tax cuts and other preferences that were included in those packages to win over Republican support. It also seemed to reflect an acknowledgement that public opinion was strongly in favor of some sort of minimum wage increase, which also appears to be true now. So do you see likelihood that Republicans are going to make another deal like they did those past two times?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because I don't think the problem is Republicans, right? The problem is Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin lives in a low-wage state where $15 is darn close to the actual median wage in the state. And it's very hard to have a minimum wage that, you know, 40 or 50% of your workforce. In Mississippi, it's literally 50% of the workforce makes less than $15 an hour. And if you think about just mandating the you raise the wages for half the people in the state. I mean, it sounds great, right? If you think you're going to get a raise, but it also, you sort of wonder, if those companies have to pay $15 an hour, why are they in Mississippi, right? In a lot of cases, they have to be their government or whatever. But if you're a textile manufacturer in Mississippi, like, why not just be somewhere else, right? And so overall, you know, there are real questions about, can you afford to operate businesses in Mississippi or in lots of parts of West Virginia or other low wage states at a $15 an hour minimum wage? And I think it's going to be very hard to get a lot. The Republicans have a lot more people from those states and those areas than the Democrats do. They tend to be a somewhat more urban party. But even they've got a big problem, which is that their swing vote happens to represent one of those states, which is going to make it extremely difficult to get a very high minimum wage across the line.
Right, but that's, I mean, I didn't say $15. Joe Manchin opposes a $15 minimum wage, but he supports raising the federal minimum wage to $11 an hour within 2 years. That would be a very large increase from the current minimum, which is $7.25. So, I don't have any illusion that a bipartisan agreement would go to $15, but I'm wondering if, you know, if Joe Manchin's on board for 11, could a lot of Republicans end up on board for something around 11?
I think it's actually probably more possible than it has been in a long time, because you've got this rising populist sentiment, not just in the party, but you have politicians like Josh Hawley who are trying to capitalize on it. That said, I also think that within the Republican Party, there is a real incentive not to ever be seen to be helping Democrats. And I think that that is, especially if Democrats try to play hardball on it, as they often get tempted to do, right, is you know, the progressive wing of the party doesn't want 11, it wants 15. It's gotten kind of weirdly anchored on 15 in a way that I'm not sure I understand. And even the Democratic coalitional politics might get interesting on this, but I think for the Republicans, there's often going to be an incentive to just hold the line and not give them a win on anything. It will be very interesting to see if people like Hawley can break that.
I think that the thing that is holding useful legislation back the most, whether it's passing a relief package, whether it's talking about the minimum wage, whether it's giving money to poor children so that they don't starve, is our politics of posturing and negative polarization and this desire to either defeat the Republicans or own the libs, which takes the place of actual governance.
I've been talking with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post. Usually August is the stupidest news month of the year, but I want to talk about some stupid news stories that have come very early this year when we come back. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at The Washington Post. Have you noticed an increase in frivolous nonsense and minor controversies that are drawing a lot of attention in the news cycle? I mean, for example, some Dr. Seuss books are at the center of one of this week's big political controversies. People are talking about Mr. Potato Head, even though Hasbro does not appear to have ever actually intended to degender the toy. They announced only that Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head were being treated as part of a Potato Head line of products, and yet people have argued about what appears to be just a garbling of that announcement for about a week. President Biden criticized Texas's move to lift restrictions as, quote, Neanderthal thinking, which has drawn a significant amount of umbrage. It's reminiscent of those old Geico commercials where the cavemen get offended over the slogan, so easy a caveman can do it, except it's actually happening in real life. And there seems to be more room for national attention to bizarre moves by local officials, such as the now suspended effort by San Francisco's school board to cancel Abraham Lincoln. I'm not even going to talk about the raunchy ads from men's clothing retailer Suit Supply about the impending end of the pandemic, which show models literally licking each other's faces while wearing only a modest amount of actual Suit Supply product. That was all over my Twitter feed on Thursday, and maybe also yours. I apologize for my part in that. But overall, I think all of this really stupid stuff is actually part of a healthy trend, which is that the news cycle is expanding to fill the space available. And that's a healthy sign that as Trump has receded, there's just more space to think about other things. And maybe those things are stupid, but I think it reflects how much of all of our mental space he was taking up for 6 years.
Let me tell you, I am delighted by this. I think this is the best news cycle we have, had in 4 years. I first noticed this happening actually when GameStop became a thing, and GameStop and meme stonks dominated the news, because that was just weird. And it was like actual news, but it was also just, oh, we're going to focus on this deeply weird and confusing, but also like kind of relevant thing for a week instead of talking about Donald Trump. This is amazing. Also, I have to say that my favorite piece of bizarre fake news that people have been discussing this week, and I apologize for even giving you this knowledge, is that trailers and images from the movie Space Jam 2 featuring LeBron James have been released, and there is a complaint on certain corners of the internet that the character Lola Bunny, Bugs Bunny's girlfriend, was very buxom in the last Space Jam, and now her boobs are not big enough. She is a cartoon rabbit. People need help. And I love that.
Megan?
Well, I would actually just like to say a word for Neanderthals. I would just like to point out, Neanderthals have larger brain cases than modern humans. And so saying that someone's comments are Neanderthal might actually be an argument that they are very, very smart. So there, Joe Biden.
The Neanderthal discourse.
Yes, the Neanderthal discourse is entirely backwards. I have a 20,000 word monograph that I would like to share with your audience.
In this essay, I will explain.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's great. I mean, I will say that there was a moment where we actually were talking about policy and I was kind of excited for that. But that was obviously some sort of weird pipe dream I had that we would spend a lot of time having, you know, feel good stories and serious issues rather than making fun of terrible, terrible suit supply ads. But I will also say I got off Twitter for Lent and like I commend it to everyone. It's amazing. I didn't know about half of these things until you mentioned them.
I'm sorry for introducing them to you.
Yes. But the third thing I would point out is that I guess YouTube might is sort of hinting that they might let Donald Trump back on. So like, enjoy it while you got it.
Well, I will say that there is actually one downside to this turn the discourse has taken, or rather something that it is revealing. The discussions about Neanderthals and cancel culture and Dr. Seuss are exceedingly stupid, and it is exceedingly stupid to watch Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio wade in because they're in favor of Neanderthals. What it's revealing, though, is that many of these arguments, many of these intense, overstuffed, fiery reactions from unfortunately Republican posturers like Rubio and Cruz are totally devoid of content. We kind of knew that, but it's become even more obvious. Like, they are really willing to rile people up about Dr. Seuss and the fact that Joe Biden said something bad about Neanderthals, who are not a constituent, as far as I know, because that just fans the flames of owning the libs and fighting and arguing and getting media time, which is apparently all that they want.
Is there a very small bit of this Dr. Seuss controversy that is actually worth talking about? You know, I have no issue with the Seuss estate pulling some relatively minor Seuss titles from publication. If you look at the images in question, they really are quite racist. It's not Green Eggs and Ham. But then as a follow-up to them stopping first-run sales of these books, then eBay announced that it's going to ban the resale of the books, which just feels a little bit weird to me that, you know, that you have eBay, this tech giant, coming in there and restricting what, you know, what private citizens can trade in this area. I understand, you know, they have a pre-existing policy against racist figurines and that sort of thing, and this sort of ends up falling under that. But I do feel a little bit weird about the, you know, these large companies coming in and sort of trying to restricting the secondary market in books. I don't know. That doesn't feel great to me.
I mean, there's a kind of weird quality of like, not only are we not going to publish them, we're going to make sure no one can see that it was ever like that. And I think that's strange. I think that is a real, I mean, I thought it was strange when Germany did it to Nazi memorabilia, but there was a much higher, like, we were actually attempting to keep this political party from coming back and taking over right now. And I don't think there's this kind of similar argument about Dr. Seuss and, you know, Reconstruction era Democrats. And so I'm not sure why we need to completely erase all vestiges of that. I think it's useful, actually, to be able to see that these things happened and that this is what society was like. And that, you know, and so I am uncomfortable with the decision to not just say, we don't do things like this anymore, but to try to actually cleanse history of the fact that they ever happened.
I mean, here's the thing, though. This is the argument about Confederate statues and, you know, sort of every instance of cancel culture, which is in part why I find this particular discussion with the locus being Dr. Seuss kind of ridiculous. Like, we have this cancel culture debate every 2 months. Dr. Seuss is a silly example. Like, read a new book, you're adults. But anyway, in the United States, anywhere really, it's not like these figures have disappeared or this knowledge will become hidden because you can't buy your racist Dr. Seuss book on eBay. Today, if you want to buy a Gollywog toy, if you want to buy a mammy figurine, if you want to buy a black jockey and put it in your front yard, you can definitely do that. I still see them around. I'm not mad at the fact that they are not on eBay. They have not been disappeared from the public imagination. There is an argument to be had about, you know, how much power large tech corporations have on our everyday lives, to the point that we think that if something doesn't exist on eBay, it doesn't exist in the world anymore. That's a bigger question that encompasses many, many things about our politics. But to say that, you know, by saying we don't really want to continue trading in these racist images and tropes is a bad thing, I think we'll be okay. Like, I just don't think that this is a hill on which people need to die.
There's one other side to this phenomenon where there's more space in the news cycle for people to focus on things, which is I think this is really causing trouble for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, which is to say you have these twin scandals that he's facing. One is about whether he sought to conceal the extent to which the state's COVID deaths were linked to nursing homes into which COVID-positive patients were being discharged from hospitals at the peak of the crisis. And then this other scandal over his treatment of employees, a couple of allegations of sexual harassment and broader claims of a bullying culture in his office as governor. This feels like the sort of story where during the Trump administration, Cuomo could have just covered his head and waited for Donald Trump to do something outrageous and people would have stopped paying attention to him. Now it's harder to hide in the news cycle, and I think that's probably a healthy thing.
Truly, the real loser in the Dr. Seuss debates is Andrew Cuomo.
Megan, do you have any thoughts on Cuomo?
Yeah, I mean, I think Cuomo successfully pitched himself as the anti-Trump, and in many ways he was a little maybe closer to his alleged opposite than we like to admit. And that is now coming home now that he doesn't have Trump as a foil. I think rightfully so. And I like to think that that YouTube will let Donald Trump back on and it will turn out no one really wants to watch him rant. And that our politics can go back to something that is a little less focused on one person and a little less riven by our visceral reactions to that one person in either direction.
I would agree with you. I think it's a good thing. I think that people who identify themselves as Cuomo-sexuals are feeling really weird and uncomfortable now, and that's good. What this moment can hopefully teach us on the right and the left is to move past this weird culture of fandom for individuals and begin to talk about real questions again, such as whether cartoon characters are sexy enough or whether Dr. Seuss is the real racist. I'm glad for us.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
So I've been spending some time on this new audio app called Clubhouse, and a lot of things have struck me. I've written about some of them, but one thing that I haven't written about is the way that every time I go and listen to people who are conservative talk, it inevitably gets into complaining about wokeness and cancel culture and all the rest of it over and over and over and over again. And I am desperately worried that this is where all the movement is becoming, is an endless series of complaints about how liberals are doing us wrong. You know, I agree with some of those complaints, but it is not productive to spend all of our time and energy either talking about how terrible it is and how unfair life is to us, and on the other hand, then just making random defiant gestures like ending mask bans while you still have 7,000 cases a day. And I really need to see a movement. I really want to see, I really hope to see a movement that can actually put forward some sort of vision for what America should be like, some sort of policies that we might get there, and then start arguing about what those should be and whether we've got the right idea. We are so far from that. And until we've done that, we will not have recovered from the damage that Trump has wrought on this party and this movement.
Christine Embo, what's your rant?
Now that vaccines are out, there is a lot of chatter about the new normal, which is, I guess, in people's minds, just days away. So included in this dialogue is these terrifying ads from Haberdasher Suit Supply that Josh mentioned. People in business wear, horribly intertwined, kissing, if you can call it that, but more like open-mouthedly licking each other's faces. It's like that horrible cat person illustration, but somehow many times worse because we're not used to seeing people touch each other anymore. Look, I'm looking forward to getting out again too, but I will be mildly feral, very poorly socialized, and still reeling from a year of confusion, grief, and ugliness in this country. I think many people will need a time for recovery, a time for grief, a time to get back to their pre-pandemic selves, you know, putting on pants, let alone zipping into a tailored suit, talking to strangers, let alone kissing them. I personally am actually maybe looking forward to licking some faces in the future, but that only shows how weird and unprepared I'm going to be for the real world. And I suspect that other people feel similarly. Please allow us some latitude before saying that everything needs to snap back into place.
For my rant, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan has refused delivery of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. He says the J&J vaccine is good, but the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are better, and he wants his residents to get the very best vaccines. There is some evidence that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are more effective than the J&J vaccine, but all of the approved vaccines are highly effective at preventing severe disease and death, which is the most important objective of the vaccine. If individuals have a vaccine preference, that's understandable, though I think the most important objective right now is to vaccinate as fast as possible with any of these vaccines. Government officials definitely shouldn't be imposing a brand preference that slows vaccination down. That's all we have time for today. Thank you to Megan McArdle and Christine Emba. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Michael Stark assisted with our recording this week, and our technical director is JC Swadek. And this is JC Swadek's last show with Left, Right, and Center. JC, I don't know if you can get on the mic. When was your first Left, Right, and Center show?
Oh, God, it definitely was 1996 for sure, when Bob Scheer, Matt, and Arianna Huffington were there.
Yeah, 1996 was the year this show launched. This show has been around so long that Arianna Huffington was the conservative panelist on the show at its birth, and JC was there very close to it. I've been hosting this show for 6 years now, and JC has been at my side and Sarah Fay's side through that time. And JC, you've just been so integral to this. I'm really sad that you're leaving, even though I know you have a great opportunity that you're moving on to. But I just really want to thank you so much for everything that you have done to make this show sound good, both during my tenure and for many years prior to it.
Thank you for everything. And who knew working on a political show was fun?
I certainly hope so. I am Josh Barrow. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.